We can do as we please with them. As you please.
Tull grabbed him round the neck, squeezing with his great big hand till the Maya's eyes were half popping out.
As you please. Does it please you to hang 'em? All right, Thunderhead, said Dow, peeling Tull's big fingers away and pushing him gently back. All right, big lad. This ain't for you, to kill a man tied up.
And he patted him on the chest, pulling out his axe.
It's for work like this you bring along a man like me.
The Maya had more or less got over his throttling now.
Thunderhead,
he coughed, looking round at them.
It's the whole lot of you, ain't it? You're three trees, and Grim, and that's the weakest there. So, you don't kneel, eh? Good for fucking you. Where's Nine Fingers, eh?
Jeered the Maya.
Where's the bloody nine?
Dow turned round, running his thumb down the edge of his axe.
Gone back to the mud, and you're joining him. We've heard enough.
Let me, you bastard!
Shouted the Maya, struggling at his ropes.
You're no better than me, Black Dow. You've killed more folk than the plague. Let me up and give me a blade. Come on. You scared to fight me, you coward? Scared to give a fair chance, are you?
Call me coward, would you? Growled Dow. You, who's killed children for the sport of it. You had a blade and you let it drop. That was your chance and you should have took it. The likes of you don't deserve another. If you've anything to say worth hearing, you best say it now.
Shit on ya! Screamed the Maya. Shit on the back of...
Dow's axe cracked him hard between the eyes and knocked him on his back. He kicked a little, then that was it. Not a one of them shed too big a tear for that bastard. Even Fawley gave no more than a wince when the blade went in. Dow leaned over and spat on his corpse, and the dogman hardly blamed him. The boy was something more of a problem, though. He stared down at the body with big wide eyes, then he looked up.
You're them, ain't ya?
He said.
Them as Nine Fingers beat.
Aye, boy, said Three Trees. We're them.
I heard stories. Stories about you. What you gonna do with me?
Well, there's the question, ain't it? Dogman muttered to himself. Shame was, he already knew the answer.
He can't stay with us, said Three Trees. We can't take the baggage, and we can't take the risk.
He's just a lad, said Fawley. We could let him go.
It was a nice thought, but it wasn't holding much water, and they all knew it. The boy looked hopeful, but Tull put an end to that.
We can't trust him, not here. He'd tell someone we were back and then we'd be hunted. Can't do it. Besides, he had his part in that work at the farm.
What choice did I have?
Asked the boy.
What choice? I wanted to go south and fight the Union and earn myself a name. But they sent me here to get taxis. My chief says do a thing, I gotta do it, don't I?
You do, said Three Trees. No one says you could have done different.
I didn't want no part of it. I told him to let the young ones be. You gotta believe me.
Fawley looked down at his boots.
We do believe you.
But you're gonna fucking kill me anyway.
Dogman chewed at his lip.
Can't take you with us. Can't leave you be.
I didn't want no part of it.
The boy hung his head.
Don't hardly seem fair.
It ain't, said Three Trees. It ain't fair at all. But there it is.
Dow's axe hacked into the back of the lad's skull, and he sprawled out on his face. The dogman winced and looked away. He knew Dow did it that way so they wouldn't have to look at the boy's face. A good idea, most likely, and he hoped it helped the others. But face up or face down was all the same to him. He felt almost as sick as he had back at the farm. It wasn't the worst day he'd ever had, not by a long way. But it was a bad one. The dogman watched them filing down the road from a good spot up in the trees where no one could see him. He made sure it was downwind from them, too, because, being honest, he was smelling a bit ripe. It was a strange old procession. On the one hand, they looked like fighting men, off to a weapon take and then to battle. On the other hand, they were all wrong. Old weapons, mostly, and odds and sods of mixed-up armour. Marching, but loose and ragged. Most of them too old to be prime fighters, grey hair and bald heads, and a lot of the rest too young for beards, hardly more than boys. Seemed to the dogman like nothing made sense in the north no more. He thought on what the Mire had said before Dow killed him. War with the Union. Were these lot off to war? If they were, then Bethod must have been scraping the pot.
"What's to do, dogman?"
asked Forley as he stepped back into the camp.
"What's happening down there?"
"Man, armed but none too well. 50 or more. Young and old, mostly, heading south and west." And the dogman pointed off down the road. Three Trees nodded.
"Towards Angland. He means it then, Bethod. He's making war on the Union all the way. No amount of blood's enough for that one. He's taking every man can hold a spear."
That was no surprise in its way. Bethod had never been one for half measures. He was all or nothing, and didn't care who got killed along the road.
"Every man," muttered Three Trees to himself. "If the Shanker come over the mountains now..."
Dogman looked round, frowning, worried, dirty faces. He knew what Three Trees was saying. They could all see it. If the Shanker came now, with no one left in the north to fight him, that business at the farm would be the best of it.
"We gotta warn someone," shouted Forley. "We gotta warn them."
Three Trees shook his head.
"You heard the Mire. Yawl's gone, and Rattleneck, and Scything. All dead and cold, and gone back to the mud. Bethod's king now, king of the Northmen."
Black Dow scowled and gobbed in the dirt.
"Spit all you like, Dow, but facts is facts. There's no one left to warn."
"No one but Bethod himself," muttered the dogman, miserable at having to say it.
"Then we gotta tell him."
Forley looked round them all, desperate.
"He may be a heartless bastard, but at least he's a man. He's better than the flatheads, isn't he? We gotta tell someone."
"Ha!" barked Dow. "Ha! You think you'll listen to us, weakest? You've forgotten what he told us? Us and Nine Fingers, too. Never come back. You've forgotten how close he come to killing us? You've forgotten how much he hates each one of us?"
"Fears us," said Grim.
"Hates and fears us," muttered Three Trees. "And he's wise, too, because we're strong, named men, known men, the type of men that others will follow."
Tull nodded his big head.
"Aye, there'll be no welcome for us at Carleon, I'm thinking. No welcome without a spike on the end of it."
"I'm not strong," shouted Forley. "I'm the weakest, everyone knows that. Bethod's got no reason to fear me, nor to hate me neither. I'll go."
Dogman looked at him, surprised. They all did.
"You?" asked Dow.
"Aye, me. I may be no fighter, but I'm no coward neither. I'll go and talk to him. Maybe he'll listen."
Dogman stood and stared. It was so long since any one of them had tried to talk their way out of a fix, he'd forgotten it could be done.
"Might be he'll listen," muttered Three Trees. "He might listen," said Tull. "Then he might bloody kill you, weakest."
Dogman shook his head. "There's quite a chance."
"Maybe. But it's worth the doing, ain't it?"
They all looked at each other, worried. It was some bones that Forley was showing, no doubt. But the dogman didn't much like the sound of this for a plan. He was a thin thread to hang your hopes on, was Bethod. A mighty thin thread. But, like Three Trees said, there was no one else. Chapter 31 Words and Dust. Kirsta pranced around the outside of the circle, his long golden hair bouncing on his shoulders, waving to the crowd, blowing kisses to the girls. The audience cheered and howled and whooped as the lithe young man made his flashy rounds. He was an Aduan, an officer of the King's Own. A local boy, and so very popular. Bremerdan Gorst was leaning against the barrier, watching his opponent dance through barely open eyes. His steels were unusually heavy-looking, weighty and worn and well-used, too heavy to be quick, perhaps. Gorst himself looked too heavy to be quick, come to that, a great thick-necked bull of a man, more like a wrestler than a swordsman. He looked the underdog in this bout. The majority of the crowd seemed to think so. But I know better. Nearby, a betmaker was shouting odds, taking money from the babbling people around him. Nearly all of the bets were for Kirster. Glockter leaned across from his bench.
"What odds are you giving on Gorst now?"
"On Gorst?" asked the betmaker.
"Evens."
"I'll take 200 marks."
"Sorry, friend, I can't cover that."
100, then, at 5-4. The betmaker thought about it for a moment, looking skywards as he worked out the sums in his head.
"Done."
Glockter sat back as the referee introduced the contestants, watching Gorst roll up his shirt sleeves. The man's forearms were thick as tree trunks, heavy cords of muscle squirming as he worked his meaty fingers. He stretched his thick neck to one side and the other, then he took his steels from his second and loosed a couple of practice jabs. Few in the crowd noticed. They were busy cheering Kirster as he took his mark. But Glockter saw. Quicker than he looks. A lot, lot quicker. Those heavy steels no longer seem so clumsy.
"Bremer, dead Gorst!"
shouted the referee, as the big man trudged to his mark. The applause was meager indeed. This lumbering bull was no one's idea of a swordsman.
"Begin!"
It wasn't pretty. From the very start, Gorst swung his heavy long steel in great heedless sweeps, like a champion woodsman chopping logs, giving throaty growls with every blow. It was a strange sight. One man was in a fencing contest, the other seemed to think he was fighting to the death. "You only have to touch him, man, not split him in half." But as Glockter watched, he realized the mighty cuts were not nearly so clumsy as they seemed. They were well-timed and highly accurate. Kirster laughed as he danced away from the first great swing, smiled as he dodged the third. But by the fifth, his smile was long gone. And it doesn't look like coming back. It wasn't pretty at all. But the power is undeniable. Kirster ducked desperately under another great arcing cut. That one was hard enough to take his head off, blunted steels or no. The crowd's favourite did his best to seize the initiative, jabbing away for all he was worth, but Gorst was more than equal to it. He grunted as he turned the jabs efficiently away with his short steel, then growled again as he brought his long, whistling around and over. Glockter winced as it smashed into Kirster's sword with a resounding crash, snapping the man's wrist back and nearly tearing the steel from his fingers. He stumbled back from the force of it, grimacing with pain and shock. Now I realize why Gorst's steel seemed so worn. Kirster dodged around the circle, trying to escape the onslaught, but the big man was too quick. Far too quick. Gorst had the measure of him now, anticipating every movement, harrying his opponent with relentless blows. There was no escape. Two heavy thrusts drove the hapless officer back towards the edge of the circle, then a scything cut ripped his long steel from his hand and embedded it, wobbling wildly back and forth, in the turf. He staggered for a moment, eyes wide, his empty hand trembling. Then Gorst was on him, letting go a roar and ramming full tilt into his defenseless ribs with a heavy shoulder. Glockter spluttered with laughter. "I never saw a swordsman fly before." Kirster actually turned half a somersault, shrieking like a girl as he tumbled through the air, crashing to the ground with his limbs flopping and sliding away on his face. He finally came to rest in the sand outside the circle, a good 3 strides from where Gorst had hit him, groaning weakly. The crowd was in shock, so quiet that Glockter's cackling had to be audible on the back row. Kirsta's trainer rushed from his enclosure and gently turned his stricken student over. The young man kicked weakly, whimpered, and clutched at his ribs. Gorst watched for a moment, emotionless, then shrugged and strolled back to his mark. Kirsta's trainer turned to the referee.
"I'm sorry," he said, "but my pupil cannot continue."
Glockter could not help himself. He had to clamp his mouth shut with his hands. His whole body was shaking with laughter. Each gurgle caused a painful spasm in his neck, but he didn't care. It seemed the majority of the crowd had not found the spectacle quite so amusing. Angry mutterings sprang up all around him. The grumbling turned to boos as Kirsta was helped from the circle, draped between his trainer and his second, then the boos to a chorus of angry shouts. Gorst swept the audience with his lazy, half-open eyes, then shrugged again and trudged slowly back to his enclosure. Glockter was still sniggering as he limped from the arena, his purse a good deal heavier than when he arrived. He hadn't had that much fun in years. The university stood in a neglected corner of the Agriont, directly in the shadow of the House of the Maker, where even the birds seemed old and tired. A huge ramshackle building, coated in half-dead ivy, its design plainly from an earlier age. It was said to be one of the oldest buildings in the city. And it looks it. The roofs were sagging in the middle, a couple of them close to outright collapse. The delicate spires were crumbling, threatening to topple off into the unkempt gardens below. The render on the walls was tired and grimy, and in places whole sections had fallen away to reveal the bare stones and crumbling mortar beneath. In one spot, a great brown stain flared out down the wall from a section of broken guttering. There had been a time when the study of sciences had attracted some of the foremost men in the Union, when this building had been among the grandest in the city. And Salt thinks the Inquisition is out of fashion. Two statues flanked the crumbling gate. Two old men, one with a lamp, one pointing at something in a book. Wisdom and Progress, or some such rubbish. The one with the book had lost his nose sometime during the past century. The other was leaning at an angle. His lamp stuck out despairingly, as though clutching for support. Glockter raised his fist and hammered on the ancient doors. They rattled, moved noticeably, as if they might at any moment drop from their hinges. Glockter waited. Waited some time. There was a sudden clatter of bolts being drawn back, and one half of the door wobbled open a few inches. An ancient face wedged itself into the gap and squinted out at him, lit underneath by a meagre taper clutched in a withered hand. Dewy old eyes peered up and down.
Yes?
Inquisitor Glockter.
Ah, from the Archlector?
Glockter frowned, surprised. Yes, that's right. They cannot be half so cut off from the world as they appear. He seems to know who I am. It was perilously dark within. Two enormous brass candelabras stood on either side of the door, but they were stripped of candles and had long gone unpolished, shining dully in the weak light from the porter's little taper.
"This way, sir,"
wheezed the old man, shambling off, bent nearly double. Even Glockter had little trouble keeping up with him as he crept away through the gloom. They shuffled together down a shadowy hallway. The windows on one side were ancient, made with tiny panes of glass so dirty that they would have let in little enough light on the sunniest of days. They let in none whatever as the sullen evening came on. The flickering candle flame danced over dusty paintings on the opposite wall. Pale old men in dark gowns of black and grey, gazing wild-eyed from their flaking frames, flasks and cogwheels and pairs of compasses clutched in their aged hands.
"Where are we going?"
asked Glockter, after they had shambled through the murk for several minutes.
"The Adepti are at dinner,"
wheezed the porter, glancing up at him with eyes infinitely tired. The university's dining hall was an echoing cavern of a room, lifted 1 degree above total darkness by a few guttering candles. A small fire flickered in an enormous fireplace, casting dancing shadows among the rafters. A long table stretched the length of the floor, polished by long years of use, flanked by rickety chairs. It could easily have accommodated 80, but there were only 5 there, crowded up at one end, huddled in around the fireplace. They looked over as the taps of Glockta's cane echoed through the hall, pausing in their meals and peering over with great interest. The man at the head of the table got to his feet and hurried over, holding the hem of his long black gown up with one hand.
"A visitor!"
wheezed the porter, waving his candle in Glockta's direction.
"Ah, from the Archlector. I am Silva, the university administrator."
And he shook Glockta's hand. His companions had meanwhile lurched and tottered to their feet as though the guest of honour had just arrived.
"Inquisitor Glockta."
He stared round at the eager old man. A good deal more deference than I was expecting, I must say. But then the Archlector's name opens all kinds of doors.
"Glockta, Glockta," mumbled one of the old men. "Seems that I remember a Glockta from somewhere."
"You remember everything from somewhere, but you never remember where," quipped the administrator to half-hearted laughter. "Please let me make the introductions."
He went round the 4 black-gowned scientists one by one.
"Saurazin, our Adeptus Chemical."
A beefy, unkempt old fellow with burns and stains down the front of his robe and more than 1 bit of food in his beard.
"Denka, the Adeptus Metallic."
The youngest of the 4 by a considerable margin, though by no means a young man, had an arrogant twist to his mouth.
"Chael, our Adeptus Mechanical."
Glockta had never seen a man with so big a head but so small a face. His ears, in particular, were immense and sprouting grey hairs.
"And Candelow, the Adeptus Physical."
A scrawny old bird with a long neck and spectacles perched on his curving beak of a nose.
"Please join us, Inquisitor."
And the administrator indicated an empty chair wedged in between 2 of the Adepti.
"A glass of wine, then?"
wheedled Chael, a prim smile on his tiny mouth, already leaning forward with a decanter and sloshing some into a glass.
"Very well. We were just discussing the relative merits of our various fields of study,"
murmured Candelow, peering at Glockta through his flashing spectacles.
"As always,"
lamented the administrator.
"The human body is, of course, the only area worthy of true scrutiny,"
continued the Adeptus Physical.
"One must appreciate the mysteries within before turning one's attention to the world without. We all have a body, Inquisitor. Means of healing it and of harming it are of paramount interest to us all. It is the human body that is my area of expertise."
"Bodies, bodies,"
whined Chael, pursing his little lips and pushing food around his plate.
"We're trying to eat." "Quite so. You're unsettling the Inquisitor with your ghoulish babble."
"Oh, I am not easily unsettled."
Glockta leered across the table, giving the Adeptus Metallic a good view of his missing teeth.
"My work for the Inquisition demands the more than passing knowledge of anatomy."
There was an uncomfortable silence. Then Saurazin took hold of the meat plate and offered it out. Glockta looked at the red slices glistening on the plate. He licked at his empty gums.
"Thank you, no."
"Is it true?"
asked the Adeptus Chemical, peering over the meat, voice hushed.
"Will there be more funds, now that this business with the Mercers is settled, that is?"
Glockta frowned. Everyone was staring at him, waiting for his reply. One of the old Adepti had his fork frozen halfway to his mouth.
"So that's it. Money. But why would they be expecting money from the Archlector?"
The heavy meat plate was beginning to wobble.
"Well, if it gets them listening."
Money might be made available, depending, of course, on results. A hushed murmur crept around the table. The Adeptus Chemical carefully set down the plate with a trembling hand.
I have been having a great deal of success with acids recently.
Ha! Mocked the Adeptus Metallic. Results! The Inquisitor asked for results! My new alloys will be stronger than steel when they're perfected.
Always the alloys,
sighed Chael, turning his tiny eyes towards the ceiling.
No one appreciates the importance of sound mechanical thinking.
The other three Adepti rounded fiercely on him, but the Administrator jumped in first.
Gentlemen, please! Inquisitor is not interested in our little differences. Everyone will have time to discuss their latest work and show its merits. This is not a competition, is it, Inquisitor?
Every eye turned towards Glockta. He looked slowly round at those old expectant faces and said nothing.
I have developed a machine for
my acids,
my alloys,
the mysteries of the human body.
Glockta cut them off. Actually, it is in the area of,
I suppose you would call them, explosive substances, that I am currently taking a particular interest.
The Adeptus Chemical jumped from his seat.
That would be my province, he cried,
staring in triumph at his colleagues.
I have samples! I have examples! Please, follow me, Inquisitor!
And he tossed his cutlery onto his plate and set off towards one of the doors. Sarrazin's laboratory was precisely as one would have expected, almost down to the last detail. A long room with a barrel-vaulted ceiling, blackened in places with circles and streaks of soot. Shelves covered most of the wall space, brimming with a confusion of boxes, jars, bottles, each filled with its own powders, fluids, rods of strange metal. There was no apparent order to the positions of the various containers, and most had no labels.
Organization does not appear to be a priority.
The benches in the middle of the room were even more confused, covered in towering constructions of glass and old brown copper. Tubes, flasks, and dishes, lamps, one with a naked flame burning, all gave the appearance of being ready at any moment to collapse, dousing anyone unfortunate enough to stand nearby with lethal boiling poisons. The Adeptus Chemical rummaged in amongst this mess like a mole in its warren.
Now then,
he mumbled to himself, pulling at his dirty beard with one hand.
Blasting powders are somewhere here.
Glockta limped into the room after him, glancing suspiciously around at the mess of tubing that covered every surface. He wrinkled his nose. There was a revolting, acrid smell to the place.
Here it is,
crowed the Adeptus, brandishing a dusty jar half full of black granules. He cleared a space on one of the benches, shoving the clinking and clanking glass and metal out of the way with a sweep of his meaty forearm.
This stuff is terribly rare, you know, Inquisitor, terribly rare!
He pulled out the stopper and tipped a line of black powder onto the wooden bench.
Few men have been fortunate enough to see this stuff in action, very few, and you are about to become one of them.
Glockta took a cautious step back, the size of the ragged hole in the wall of the Tower of Chains still fresh in his mind.
We are safe, I hope, at this distance.
Absolutely,
murmured Sarrazin, gingerly holding a burning taper out at arm's length and touching it to one end of the line of powder.
There is no danger,
There was a sharp pop and a shower of white sparks. The Adeptus Chemical leapt back, nearly blundering into Glockta and dropping his lighted taper on the floor. There was another pop, louder, more sparks. A foul-smelling smoke began to fill the laboratory. There was a bright flash and a loud bang, a weak fizzling, and that was all. Sarrazin flapped the long sleeve of his gown in front of his face, trying to clear the thick smoke that had now thrown the whole chamber into gloom.
Impressive, eh, Inquisitor?
He asked, before dissolving into a fit of coughing.
Not really.
Glockter ground the still-flaming taper out under his boot and stepped through the murk towards the bench. He brushed aside a quantity of grey ash with the side of his hand. There was a long black burn on the surface of the wood, but nothing more. The foul-smelling fumes were indeed the most impressive effect, already clawing at the back of Glockter's throat.
"It certainly produces a great deal of smoke," he croaked.
"It does," coughed the Adeptus proudly, "and reeks to high heaven."
Glockter stared at that blackened smear on the bench.
"If one had a large enough quantity of this powder, could it be used to, say, knock a hole through a wall?"
"Possibly. If one could accumulate a large enough quantity, who knows what could be done? As far as I know, no one has ever tried."
"A wall, say, 4 feet thick?"
The Adeptus frowned.
"Perhaps, but you'd need barrels of the stuff. Barrels! There isn't that much in the whole Union. And the cost, even if it could be found, would be colossal. Please understand, Inquisitor, that the components must be imported from the distant south of Cantor, and a rarities even there. I would be happy to look into the possibility, of course, but I would need considerable funding."
"Thank you again for your time."
Glockter turned and began to limp through the thinning smoke towards the door.
"I have made some significant progress with assets recently," cried the Adeptus, voice cracking. "You really should see those as well."
He took a shuddering breath.
"Tell the Arch-Lector, significant progress."
He dissolved into another fit of coughing, and Glockter shut the door tightly behind him.
A waste of my time. Our buyers could not have smuggled barrels of powder into that room. Even then, how much smoke, how great a smell would it have made? A waste of my time.
Silver was lurking in the hallway outside.
"Is there anything else that we can show you, Inquisitor?"
Glockter paused for a moment.
"Doth anyone here know anything about magic?"
The administrator's jaw muscles clenched.
"A joke, of course. Perhaps—"
"Magic," I said.
Silver narrowed his eyes.
"You must understand that we are a scientific institution. The practice of magic, so-called, would be most inappropriate."
Glockter frowned at the man.
"I'm not asking you to get your wand out, fool."
"From an historical standpoint," he snapped. "The Magi and so on? Buyers." "Ah, from an historical standpoint, I see."
Silver's taut face relaxed slightly.
"Our library contains a wide range of ancient texts, some of them dating back to the period when magic was considered less remarkable."
"Who can assist me?"
The administrator raised his brows.
"I'm afraid that the Adeptus Historical is something of a relic."
"I need to speak with him, not fence with him."
"Of course, Inquisitor. This way."
Glockter grabbed the handle of an ancient-looking door, studded with black rivets, began to turn it. He felt Silver seize his arm.
"No!"
he snapped, guiding Glockter away down a corridor beside.
"The stacks are down here."
The Adeptus Historical seemed indeed to be a part of ancient history himself. His face was a mask of lined and sagging, half-transparent skin. Sparse hairs, snowy white, stuck unkempt from his head. There were only a quarter as many as there should have been, but each was 4 times longer than you would expect. Hence his eyebrows were thin, yet sprouted out to impressive length in all directions, like the whiskers of a cat. His mouth hung slack, weak, and toothless. Hands were withered gloves, several sizes too big. Only his eyes showed any trace of life, peering up at Glockter and the administrator as they approached.
"Visitor, is it?"
croaked the old man, apparently talking to a large black crow perched on his desk.
"This is Inquisitor Glockter," bellowed the administrator, leaning down towards the old man's ear.
"Glockter?"
From the Archlector.
This?
The Adeptus Historical squinted up with his ancient eyes.
He's somewhat deaf, Silber murmured. But no one knows these books like he does.
He thought about it for a moment, peering round at the endless stacks disappearing into the gloom.
No one else knows these books at all.
Thank you, said Glockter. The administrator nodded and strode off towards the stairs. Glockter took a step towards the old man, and the crow leapt from the table and scrambled into the air, shedding feathers, flapping madly around the ceiling. Glockter hobbled painfully back. I was sure the damn thing was stuffed. He watched it suspiciously until it clattered to a halt on top of one of the shelves and perched there motionless, staring at him with its beady yellow eyes. Glockter pulled out a chair and dropped into it.
I need to know about Baez.
Baez?
Muttered the ancient Adeptus.
The first letter in the alphabet of the old tongue, of course.
I didn't know that.
The world's brimming full of what you don't know, young man.
The bird gave a sudden harsh caw, horribly loud in the dusty silence of the stacks.
Brimming full.
Then let's begin my education. It's the man Baez I need to know about, the first of the Magi.
Baez, the name Great Juvens gave to his first apprentice. One letter, one name. First apprentice, first letter of the alphabet. You understand?
I'm just about keeping up. Did he really exist?
The ancient Adeptus scowled.
Unquestionably. Did you not have a tutor as a young man?
I did, unfortunately.
Did he not teach you history?
He tried, but my mind was on fencing and girls.
Ah, I lost interest in such things a long time ago.
So did I. Let us return to Baez.
The old man sighed.
Long ago, before there was a union, Middleland was made of many petty kingdoms, often at war with one another, rising and falling with the passing years. One of these was ruled by a man called Harod, later to become Harod the Great. You've heard of him, I assume?
Of course.
Baez came to Harod's throne room and promised to make him king of all Middleland if he did as he was told. Harod, being young and headstrong, did not believe him, but Baez broke the long table with his art.
Magic, eh?
So the story goes. Harod was impressed.
Understandable.
And he agreed to accept the advice of the Magus.
Which was?
To make his capital here in Adua. To make peace with certain neighbors, war with others. And when and how to do it?
The old man squinted across at Glockter.
Are you telling this story or am I?
You are. And you're taking your time about it.
Baez was good as his word. In time, Middleland was unified. Harod became its first high king. The union was born.
Then what?
Baez served as Harod's chief counselor. Our laws and statutes, the very structure of our government, all are said to be his inventions, little changed since those ancient days. He established the councils, closed and open. He formed the Inquisition. On Harod's death, he left the Union, promising one day to return.
I see. How much of this is true, do you think?
Hard to say. Magus, wizard, magician?
The old man looked at the flickering candle flame.
To a savage, that candle might be magic. It's a fine line indeed between magic and trickery, eh? But this Baez was a cunning mind in his day, that's a fact.
This is all useless. What about before?
Before what?
Before the Union, before Harrod.
The old man shrugged.
Record-keeping was hardly a priority during the Dark Ages. The whole world was in chaos after the war between Juvens and his brother Canadius.
Canadius? The master-maker?
Aye.
Canadius. He stares down from the walls of my little room in the cellars beneath Severard's charming townhouse. Juvens dead, his 11 apprentices, the Magi, marching to avenge him. I know this tale.
Canadius, murmured Glockter, the image of that dark figure with the flames behind clear in his mind.
The Master Maker, was he real?
Hard to say. He's in the ground between myth and history, I suppose. Probably there's some grain of truth in it. Someone must have built that big bloody tower, eh?
Tower?
The House of the Maker!
The old man gestured at the room around them.
And they say he built all this as well.
What, this library?
The old man laughed.
The whole Agrihont! Or at least the rock on which it stands. The university, too. He built it, appointed the first adepti to help him with his works, whatever they were, to look into the nature of things. We here are the Maker's disciples, yes, though I doubt they know it upstairs. He is gone, but the work continues, eh?
After a fashion, where did he go?
Dead. Your friend Baez killed him.
Glockter raised an eyebrow.
Did he really?
So the story goes. Have you not read The Fall of the Master Maker?
That rubbish. I thought it was all invention.
So it is. Sensational claptrap, but based on writings from the time.
Writings? Such things survive?
The old man narrowed his eyes.
Some?
Some? You have them here?
One in particular.
Glockter fixed the old man with his eye.
Bring it to me.
The ancient paper crackled as the Adeptus Historical carefully unrolled the scroll and spread it out on the table. The parchment was yellow and crumpled. Edges rough with age, scrawled with a dense script, strange characters, utterly unintelligible to Glockter's eye.
What is it written in?
The old tongue. Few can read this now.
The old man pointed to the first line.
An account of the fall of Canadius, this says, the third of three.
Third of three?
Of three scrolls, I presume.
Where are the other two?
Lost.
Glockter peered into the endless darkness of the stacks.
It's a wonder anything can be found down here. What does this one say?
The ancient librarian peered down at the strange writing, poorly illuminated by the single flickering candle, his trembling forefinger tracing across the parchment, his lips moving silently.
Great! Was their fury?
What?
That's how it begins. Great was their fury.
He began slowly to read.
The Magi pursued Canadius, driving his faithful before them. They broke his fortress, laying ruin to his buildings and killing his servants. The Maker himself, sore wounded in the battle with his brother Juvens, took refuge in his house.
The old man unrolled a little more.
12 days and 12 nights the Magi threw their wrath against the gates, but could not mark them. Then Baez found a way inside.
The Adeptus swept his hand over the parchment in frustration. Damp or something had blurred the characters in the next section.
I can't make this out. Something about the Maker's daughter?
You sure?
No.
snapped the old man. There's a whole section missing.
Ignore it, then. What's the next thing you can be sure of?
Well, let's see. Baez followed him to the roof and cast him down.
The old man noisily cleared his throat.
The Maker fell burning and broke upon the bridge below. The Magi searched high and low for the seed, but could not find it.
Seed? Asked Glockter, baffled.
That's all that's written.
What the hell does it mean?
The old man sagged back in his chair, evidently enjoying this rare opportunity to hold forth on his area of expertise. The end of the Age of Myths, the beginning of the Age of Reason. Baez, the Magi, they represent order. The Maker is a godlike figure. Superstition, ignorance, I don't know. There must be some truth to him. After all, someone built that big bloody tower, and he wheezed with breathy laughter.
Glockter could not be bothered to point out that the Adeptus had made the very same joke a few minutes before. And it wasn't funny then. Repetition, the curse of the old.
What about this seed? Magic? Secrets? Power? It's all a metaphor.
I will not impress the Archlector with metaphors, especially bad ones.
Is there no more? It goes on a bit, let's see.
He looked back at the symbols.
He broke on the bridge. They searched for the seed.
Yes, yes.
Patience, Inquisitor.
His withered finger traced across the characters.
They sealed up the house of the Maker. They buried the fallen, Canadius and his daughter among them. That's all.
He peered at the page, his finger hovering over the last few letters.
And Baez took the key, that's all.
Glockter's eyebrows went up.
What? What was that last bit? They sealed the gates, they buried the fallen, and Baez took the key.
The key? The key to the house of the Maker? The Adeptus Historical squinted back at the page.
That's what it says.
There is no key. That tower has stood sealed for centuries. Everyone knows it. Our impostor will have no key, that's sure.
Slowly, Glockter began to smile.
It is thin. It is very thin. But with the right setting, the right emphasis, it might be enough. The Archlector will be pleased.
I'll be taking this.
Glockter pulled the ancient scroll over and started to roll it up.
What?
The eyes of the Adeptus were wide with horror.
You can't!
He staggered up from his chair even more painfully than Glockter might have done. His crows scrambled up with him, flapping around near the ceiling and croaking in a fury, but Glockter ignored them both.
You can't take it! It's irreplaceable!
Wheezed the old man, making a hopeless grab for the scroll.
Glockter spread his arms out wide.
Stop me! Why don't you? I'd like to see it. Can you imagine? We two cripples, floundering around in the stacks with a bird loosing its droppings on us, tugging this old piece of paper to and fro?
He giggled to himself.
That wouldn't be very dignified, would it?
The Adeptus Historical, exhausted by his pitiful efforts, crumpled back into his chair, breathing hard. No one cares about the past anymore, he whispered. They don't see that you can't have a future without a past.
How very deep.
Glockter slipped the rolled-up parchment into his coat and turned to leave. Who's going to look after the past? When I'm gone.
Who cares?
Asked Glockter as he stalked towards the steps.
As long as it isn't me.
Chapter 32 The Remarkable Talents of Brother Longfoot. The cheering had woken Logan every morning for a week. It started early, ripping him from his sleep, loud as a battle close at hand. He thought it was a battle when he first heard it, but now he knew it was just their damn stupid sport. Closing the window brought some relief from the noise, but the heat soon became unbearable. It was sleep a little or sleep not at all, so he left the window open. Logan rubbed his eyes, cursing, and hauled himself from his bed. Another hot, tedious day in the city of White Towers. On the road, in the wild, he'd be alert as soon as his eyes opened. But here, things were different. The boredom and the heat were making him slow and lazy. He stumbled across the threshold into the living room, yawning wide and rubbing at his jaw with one hand. He stopped. There was someone in there, a stranger, standing at the window, bathed in sunlight with his hands clasped behind him. A small, slight man, with hair shaved close to his knobbly skull and strange travel-worn clothes, faded, baggy cloth wrapped round and round his body. Before Logan had a chance to speak, the man turned and sprang nimbly over to him. "And you are?" he demanded. His smiling face was deeply tanned and weather-beaten, like the creased leather on a favorite pair of boots. It made it impossible to guess his age. He could have been anywhere from 25 to 50. "Nine fingers," muttered Logan, taking a cautious step back towards the wall.
"Nine fingers, yes."
The little man pressed forwards and seized Logan's hand in both of his, gripping it tightly.
"It is an honor and privilege most profound,"
he said, closing his eyes and bowing his head,
"to make your acquaintance."
"You've heard of me?"
"Alas, no, but all God's creatures are worthy of the deepest respect."
He bowed his head again.
"I am Brother Longfoot, a traveller of the illustrious Order of Navigators. There are few lands beneath the sun upon which my feet have not trodden."
He pointed down towards his well-worn boots, then spread his arms wide.
"From the mountains of Thond to the deserts of Shamir, from the plains of the old empire to the silver waters of the Thousand Isles, all the world is my home, truly."
He spoke the northern tongue well, better than Logan himself, perhaps.
"And the north, too?"
"One brief visit in my youth, I found the climate somewhat harsh."
"You speak the language well enough."
"There are few tongues that I, Brother Longfoot, cannot speak. An effortless skill with languages is but one among my many remarkable talents."
The man beamed.
"God has truly blessed me," he added.
Logan wondered if this might be some elaborate joke.
"What brings you here?"
"I have been sent for."
His dark eyes sparkled.
"Sent for?"
"Indeed I have, by Baez, the first of the Magi. I have been sent for, and I have come. That is my way. A most generous contribution to the coffers of the Order has been made in return for my remarkable talents, but I would have come without it. Indeed, without it."
"Really?"
"Indeed."
The small man stepped away and started to stride around the room at a terrific pace, rubbing his hands together.
"The challenge of this assignment spoke as much to the pride of the Order as to its well-documented greed, and it was I who was selected from all the navigators within the circle of the world for this task. I, Brother Longfoot, I and no other. Who, in my position of my reputation, could resist such a challenge?"
He stopped before Logan and looked up at him expectantly, as if waiting for an answer to his question.
"Not I,"
shouted Longfoot, setting off on another circuit of the room.
"I did not resist it. Why would I? That would not be my way. To journey to the very edge of the world? What a tale that will make! What an inspiration to others! What an—"
"The edge of the world?" asked Logan suspiciously.
"I know!"
The strange man clapped him on the arm.
"We are equally excited!" "This must be our navigator."
Baez emerged from his room.
"I am indeed, Brother Longfoot, at your service. And you are, I presume, none other than my illustrious employer Baez, the first of the Magi."
"I am he."
"It is an honor and a privilege most profound,"
cried Longfoot, springing forward and seizing the Magus by the hand.
to make your acquaintance.
Likewise. I trust your journey was a pleasant one?
Journeys are always pleasant to me, always. It is the time between them that I find trying. Indeed it is.
Byers frowned over at Logan, but he could only shrug his shoulders.
May I ask how long it will be until we begin our journey? I am most keen to embark.
Soon, I hope, the last member of our expedition will arrive. We will need to charter a ship.
Of course, it shall be my particular pleasure to do so. What shall I tell the captain of our course?
West across the Circle Sea to Staryxa, then on to Chalcis in the Old Empire. The little man smiled and bowed low. You approve?
I do, but ships rarely pass to Chalcis now. The Old Empire's endless wars have made the waters dangerous thereabouts. Piracy, alas, is rife. It may be difficult to find a captain willing.
This should help.
Byers tossed his ever-bulging purse onto the table.
It should indeed.
Make sure the ship is fast. Once we are ready, I do not wish to waste a day.
On that you may depend,
said the navigator, scooping up the heavy bag of coins.
To sail in slow vessels is not my way. No, I will find you the fastest ship in all Adua. Yes, she shall fly like the breath of God. She shall skip over the waves like...
Merely fast will do.
The little man inclined his head.
The time of departure?
Within the month.
Byers looked at Logan.
Why don't you go with him?
Huh?
Yes!
Shouted the navigator.
We will go together!
He grabbed Logan by the elbow and began to pull him towards the door.
I will expect some change, Brother Longfoot,
called Byers from behind. The navigator turned in the doorway.
There will be change, on that you may depend. An eye for value, a flair for barter, a dauntless purpose in negotiation. These are but three,
and he smiled broadly,
of my remarkable talents. It is a fabulous place, this Adua, truly. Few cities are its equal. Shaffa, perhaps, is larger, but so very dusty. None could deny that Westport and Degosca have their sites. Some think of Ospria on its mountain slopes as the most beautiful city of the world, but Brother Longfoot's heart, it must be said, belongs to Great Talons. Have you been there, Master Ninefingers? Have you seen that noble settlement?
Logan was busy trying to keep up with the little man, dodging between the endless flow of people. Longfoot stopped so suddenly that Logan almost piled into him. The navigator turned, his hands raised, a faraway look in his eye.
Talons at sunset, seen from the ocean. I have witnessed many remarkable things, believe me, but I declare that to be the most beautiful sight in all the world. The way the sun gleams on the myriad canals, on the glinting domes of the Grand Duke's citadel, on the graceful palaces of the merchant princes. Where now does the shining sea end and the shining city begin? Ah, Talons!
He turned and charged off once more, and Logan hurried after him.
But this Adua is a fine place, certainly, and growing every year. Things have changed a great deal here since my last visit. Indeed they have. Once there were only noblemen and commoners. The noblemen owned the land, so they had the money and therefore the power. Simple, you see?
Well, Logan was having trouble seeing much further than Longfoot's back.
But now they have trade, and so much of it. Merchants and bankers and so forth, everywhere, armies of them. Now commoners can be rich, you see? And a rich commoner has power. Is he a commoner now, or a nobleman? Or is he something else? Very complicated all of a sudden, no? So much wealth, so much money, but so much poverty too, eh? So many beggars, so many poor. Hardly healthy, so rich and so poor, so close together, but it's a fine place still, and always growing.
I find it too crowded, mumbled Logan as a shoulder barged past him, and too hot.
Bah! Crowded?
Do you call this crowded? You should see the great temple in Shafa at morning prayer, or the grand square before the emperor's palace when new slaves are up for auction. And hot? Do you call this hot? In Ulsafine, in the far south of Gurkul, it gets so hot during the summer months that you can cook an egg on your doorstep. Truly. This way.